I've worked with stevia for a number of years. In the last 9 years, I've been doing breeding and selection. And I got curious about tetraploids because polyploidy and tetraploids are mentioned in several literature articles. So stevia is a plant that's native of northeastern Paraguay and just a few isolated spots. It's an asteraceae, has very sweet leaf flavor, and is interested for the stevial glycosides that are used as natural non-caloric sweeteners and many different products. Well, what are the limiting factors in stevia production? It's just not produced nearly as much as what the potential market is. And it comes down to the cost of production in the field. There's a lot of cost of establishment in transplanting the plants in the field, lack of product registration for weed and disease control, leaf productivity and quality, and the cost of leaf drying. So if we're going to look at tetraploids, we're really interested in increasing productivity and quality. Other authors have suggested, this is a tetraploid here, picture there, they've suggested that tetraploids have shorter internode length, enhanced leaf size, leaf thickness, larger and fewer stomata, changes in trichomes, more chlorophyll, increased leaf productivity, increased or decreased plant height, increased steviocyte and roboticide A, or I measured like 14 different stevial glycosides, but there's sort of controversy on these points 7 and 8. And if you have decreased plant height, how could you have increased leaf productivity? It sounds sort of contradictory to me. And also, people have made tetraploids using colchicine on seed and on buds. Well, if you do it on seed, and then there's a question of what is the standard that you're measuring it against, because the seed are all genetically different from the parent, or they're different from the seed that you haven't treated. And so how do you get a really unbiased set of data? So since I have many elite lines that have very high good properties, I thought, well, now I'm going to try this on the buds of elite lines to see if I get increases instead of training on sort of stuff that's maybe marginal, and then you have the bias of what you select out of it. So I wondered whether there's bias in the literature. And if it's really true, you know, it would be a powerful tool for enhancing the production. So I use these three lines that I made tetraploids out of. And each of these lines has high roboticide A, possible to get 12 to 18, depending on the time of harvest, and high Reb A to steviocyte ratio, some of them over, 10 to 15 to 1. And high stevial glycoside, so ranging from, 16 to 20 or more percent of the leaf dry weight. And since the results are very complicated and looking at, three different species, two different years, and 14 different stevial glycosides, I'm simplifying the results down to a couple little tables. So we took nodal cuttings that treated with 1% colchicine for 24 hours. Tetraploids were confirmed by flow cytometry screen, make sure that we had tetraploids. And then we had a field trial with 5 replicates and in 2017, but with only one tetraploid. And then 2018, we had the 3 tetraploids with 4 replicates, relative leaf size and all stevioglycosides and their corresponding diploids. So that's a relatively limited experiment, but just to try this tetraploid idea out. Well, so here's the, I'll present the data for 1 year between one diploid, this 15-3, and its corresponding tetraploid 15-T1. And by observation, you can see that the leaves are slightly longer. There's fewer branches, which is troubling. Leaves are very slightly wider, less, not statistically significant. And one is immediately, these are planted out isolated together because for yield, they have packed all together with borders and all that. So one immediately has some concerns whether this is going to pan out. And you can see from, we had over 6.7 tons per hectare of dry leaf production of the diploid, and the tetraploid was only about two-thirds the yield. And that, I believe that's directly related to the number of branches that came out of the plant. And if, when we look at the stevial glycosides, there was significantly more steviocide in the tetraploid. Most of the stevial glycosides had no significant difference, and the ribodiocyte A was consistently less, but not statistically significantly less. The total stevial glycosides was consistently was less, and across all the various combinations, not statistically significantly less, but less in terms of concentration. So when you combine significantly less yield with toss-up in ribodiocyte A and in total stevia glycosides, there's really nothing to be gained from the three species that, the three cultivars that I did this tetraploid process to. So in conclusion, didn't have any advantages. So I'm trying to compete for the shortest possible presentation here. So are there any questions? Yes.
Yeah, so Rev A is one of the most common, commonly marketed stevia glycosides, but it's not the most flavorful. It has that nasty sort of licorice aftertaste, right? So are there any, in your tetraploids, were there any that mentioned like Rev C or Rev M that were higher in some of the tetraploids but not in the
So the question is, there's both a statement that Rev A is, has a off flavor, and there's the statement, was there any significant difference of any of the other ribodiocides that are reported to have better taste? Okay, none of the other stevoglycosides had any significant difference based on whether it's a diploid or tetraploid. There's based on your comment about the taste of ribodiocyte A, the flavor and taste of ribodiocyte A has a different profile based on, you made these crazy diagrams, with different components of taste, bitterness, aftertaste, blah, 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 based on, and so on ribodiocyte A, as you go from 80% pure to 90% pure to 95% pure to 98% pure to 99.5% pure, the diagram changes. So, is it the contamination that's causing the undesirable effects? Secondly, if one in one's breeding eliminates plants that have the worst taste every year, then you end up with a plant material that is shifting towards having fewer off-taste compounds. In which case, if you're doing that, with your subjective evaluation, you can no longer determine, you can no longer sort whether you're really tasting Reb A or stevia side or whatever, because you end up selecting plants with high total stevia glycosides, and you have no real idea whether it's Reb A or stevia side or whatever. So when you get into about the fifth or sixth generation where you're tasting all the progeny, and if they have significant bitterness or flavor, you don't even touch it again, you throw it away, regardless of the sweetness, then the world starts changing. Yes?
I just wonder if your category is stable. I mean, based on low cytometry, do you test if they are really stable category?
The question is whether the tetraploids are stable. Yeah, those plants that I showed you were the probably the fourth generation of vegetative cuttings. So between the time the cuttings were the original were made and then multiplied, they haven't changed, or I haven't noticed whether they've changed. Any other questions or any other questions about stevia? Yes, go ahead. Are there any natural occurring tetraploids? They're naturally occurring tetraploids and triploids. And they tend to have larger leaves. There's approximately 200 species of stevia. And the other species are not sweet. And of those species, they have many different attributes. And most of them have, they have 11 pairs of chromosomes or 12 pairs of chromosomes. And there was one species that was reported to be sweet in Mexico, but it was never found again. So it probably doesn't exist. I think there's a lot of opportunity within the genus. Because part of the problem of Stevia rhabdiana is that it only existed as a little micro population. So when I started growing it in 69, and in there was a company in Asuncion that wanted to make a plantation. So I went to the centers of origin and collected the plants. Well, it only existed in a tiny ecological site in two spots. And it was an ecological, nutritional desert. And so it existed in a tiny band between upland nutritional desert, an area with 60, 70 inches of rainfall a year, and marshes. So it was where the water table was only about 18 inches deep, about 0.3 meters, near this totally infertile marsh, an upland, totally infertile upland, where you could see, you know, vast forests around. And so the plant is adapted to extremely infertile soil and no water stress. So it doesn't have very much going for it as a commercial plant. Thank you.